Promise to who? Is it promised to the people that are so desperately seeking to occupy this land without regard of who they hurt, who they kill? What is their purpose for being there? Is it that of the Bible? Or is it for a people looking to possess and control everything out of greed? We're going to take a look at these people and this geographic area and look and see just what is happening by their actions. It is simply for control of resources and shipping. Okay, now I'm going to invite you to take a journey down the rabbit hole with me, all the way back in time. We're going to go to the days of Noah. And in the days of Noah, where it talks about his sons. And for this portion of it, we're going to actually go into the Bible. We'll go into the Bible at Genesis 10, 1 through 3. Now this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And sons were born to them after the flood. Genesis 10, 2, the sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Mesha, and Tiras. Genesis 10, 3, the sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz, Rephath, and Togarmah. I gotta really say I love these maps because they show the migratory patterns for the sons of Noah, where actually Shem stayed in the Arabian Peninsula, Ham went over to Egypt and North Africa and spread out from there, and then Japheth, he went basically up through Turkey and the Caucasus Mountains and went east and west from there. Now just in case any of you didn't know this, the Caucasus Mountains is the region where Caucasians came from. So anybody that came up through the Caucasus Mountains and migrated up from there are Caucasian. That would include the Chinese and all the way to the Nordic people. So with that in mind, the people that are actually occupying the land of Palestine today are actually Caucasians. They are not the Semitic people that they claim to be. Around 90% of the people that are claiming to be these Hebrew Israelites, they're actually Ashkenazi. Now, there is one addendum I want to make to that. Now, there are the Sephardic Jewish people. They are Semite, but they are not Hebrew Israelites. They come from Israel slash Jacob's twin brother, Esau. He lost his inheritance, and therefore he is not from the 12 tribes of Israel whatsoever, although they are Semitic people. I'll repeat that. They are not Hebrew Israelites. In this next part, we're going to use art and archaeology to show the same points that we made through the Bible. The Bible was not for a Sunday school lesson. It was for the genealogy. The Hebrew Israelites are not Caucasian. They never have been and never will be. Even the Pope prays to a black baby Jesus. George Friedman, in his book, The End of Jewish People, pointedly states that Europeans claiming to be Jews are nothing more than Hebrew-speaking Gentiles. The late president of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser, stated on television, you Jews, will never be able to live here in peace because you left black and came back white. We cannot accept you. Now look, everybody in the Middle East knows that these people that are occupying Palestine are imposters, and that's part of the reason why everybody's so upset with them over there.
I don't hide in my book my political positions in the end, even if I'm a historian. Then to expose you my decomposition of the idea of a Jewish people, the decomposition of the idea of a Jewish people, then my book, that is a historical book, after the Bible, showing that the Bible is not a historical text, I try to show in the first chapter, historical chapter, that the Bible is not a historical book. Not the First Testament and not the second one. It's a very great theological text. I remember thinking only to write about history in the Bible. And then I arrived to the question of the exile of the Jew from Judea, from Palestine. You see, as an Israeli pupil, I was educated
like all the others.
The Jews were expelled from Palestine. In some moment in the book, I remember writing the book, I went to the library looking for research, scientific book about the exile of the Jews from Judea. I'm quite sure that there are people here that believe the Jews were expelled by the Romans from Judea. No, I'm quite sure. Not only the Jews between you. I remember going to the library and I didn't find one research book, scientific book about the expel of the Jews. And I started to work about it and ask what happened with the people in Palestine, in Judea, in the land of Israel. What happened with them? If they were not expelled, what happened with them? And you know, step by step, I discovered by Roman historians, even Jewish historians, that most of the population in Judea that wasn't expelled by the Romans, by the way, the Romans didn't expel people. The Jews become Christian, and after it, Muslims. They become much more Muslims than Christian. You know why? Because Judaism is much more nearer to the Islam than to Christianity, even if you define today the civilization of Europe as a Judo-Christian civilization. I will, in the answers, if you will have questions, I make it more clear, my critic. Between Jews and Muslims, there is not a problem of killing the God. The Muslims don't believe that we killed their son of God. It's very important. Okay, and also, the Muslims didn't believe that a God can make a son, like the Jew. Then the population become Muslims without knowing that they become Muslims. Because Muhammad is another prophet that recognized all the other prophets before. That my conclusion that in the 70th century, most of the Jews become Muslims. It's not my opinion. I'm not original. The first Zionist coming to Palestine, Ben-Gurion, you heard the name David Ben-Gurion? They believe that the Arabs in Palestine are the descendant of the Jews. It's not me. Till the first revolt of the local people against the Zionist colonization, Zionists say that the Palestinians are the real descendant of the ancient Hebrew. And they accuse me that I believe that Palestinians today, they are the real Jews. The real Jews, the real descendant of the Jews.
The Palestinians.
No. I think that Palestinians of today are a mixture. Now, I don't believe that the Palestinians are the direct descendant of the ancient Hebrew. I think that it's a people, a mixed people, like all the people in the world. Even the Bulgarian. Sorry. But the chance that a Palestinian will be a descendant is much greater than me and a lot of Jews that are in this room. Sorry again. Now, if the Jews were not expelled from Judea, how come that there are so many Jews in the world? The answer is very simple. Judaism was the first proselytic religion in the Western monotheism.
Today I would like to present our work, Understanding the Origins of Ancient Ashkenaz and the Yiddish Language. This work was done in collaboration with Paul Wexler and other colleagues. The purpose of this work was to understand the geographical origins of the Yiddish language. It's one of the last European languages whose linguistic and geographical classification remain unclear, even after 300 years of research. Yiddish is the native language of Ashkenazic Jews, whose own origin remain debatable, which gave us hope that if we can localize that language, we can also localize the origin of Ashkenazic Jews. Assuming that the history of these two is parallel, as Weinrich noted, at least in part, that would be able to, this would work. Another question we were hoping to answer is, where is Ashkenaz? Ashkenaz, as you know, is one of the most disputed biblical place names. It is mentioned only a few times, twice in the context of Noah's descendants, and once in reference to some legendary kingdom that would wage war on Babylon and the end of the days. This is the first study that analyzed the genetic data of Yiddish speakers, so of course Ashkenazic Jews, but specifically Yiddish speakers, and it is carried out at a time where there are fewer and fewer people who speak solely Yiddish, willing to participate in such study. Our rationale was that there is a very well-established relationships between genetics, geography, and language. Genetics can be translated to geographical regions using a tool that we developed. It's called Geographic Population Structure, or GPS. And again, the relationships between language and geography have been studied very, very well. Altogether, if we considered all these three, we should be able to answer the question, who are Ashkenazic Jews, where they're from, and where Yiddish has originated. Of course, there is a lot of interest in answering those questions. And as you can see in this figure that I grabbed from the internet, I don't know how reliable it is. It simply shows there is a lot of interest in mapping place names from the Bible to an actual locations, and if you look close enough, you can see that only Ashkenaz is mentioned twice, because there's never been an uncertainty as to where it is. Okay, this is based on the names mentioned in Genesis 10. We followed two hypotheses in this work, comparing two possible scenarios. The first, the left one in the blue, is called the Rhineland hypothesis. This hypothesis presumes that at some point the Judeans were exiled to Rome in the year of 70. This, of course, event that has never happened. Shlomo Sand discussed that at length in his book, The Invention of the Jewish People. But let's moving on from this. After their arrival in Rome at some point, they presumably were released from captivity, migrated into Franconia, and then to the Rhineland, where they adopted some German dialect, and it turned out into Yiddish. And in the mid-13th century, mass migration to Eastern Europe, and at that point, they experienced a demographic miracle that created a very large Jewish community. Needless to say, this miracle event, I don't need to mention that it is disputed. It is sufficient to say that it should not be considered science. However, you'd be surprised how many people write that in their papers as if this is a reasonable and viable explanation. The reason it is called demographic miracle is because it requires us to assume that Ashkenazic Jews reproduced at experienced a baby boom expansion rate for 500 years at a time where some of European nations have been contracted because of the Black Death and so forth. That growth rate is unimaginable, and it cannot be generated through normal reproduction rate, hence the demographic miracle. The alternative hypothesis is called the Slavo Irano-Turkish hypothesis, suggests that at some point, Iranian Jewry became very well developed, initially founded by travelers, supplemented by exiles from Israel and Judea. And of course, by that time, there was not much of Israel left, but the Judeans took the name Israel. At some point, those Jewish traders arrived to the Black Sea, Slavic lands, and crossed the Caucasus Mountains. They influenced religion reform in the Khazarian Empire, where the Khazar elites converted to Judaism. Many other people converted at the same time, including Slavs and other people who wanted to take part of this Jewish trade. At that time, they began using Pradish, the Slavic version of Yiddish. After Khazaria collapsed, those Jews penetrated Europe from the east. They moved west from the Khazarian Empire to Europe. After they arrived in Germany, they began adapting Germanic words into their pre-Yiddish language that they had, that had a Slavic base, Slavic grammar. And this is how Yiddish became to sound like German. And eventually they reached Western Europe and the remaining parts of Europe. Okay. Now, the two hypotheses count and classify the number of words in Yiddish and trace them back to their supposedly parental language in two different ways. The Rindlin hypothesis suggests that most of the words in Yiddish have Germanic bases with a little bit of Slavic and a tiny bit of Hebrew. The Slavo-Irano-Turkic hypothesis suggests that actually most of the words are from Slavic origin. The remaining are German or Germanoid. That means sounds like German, but not really. And I can give you a contemporary word. The word Ashkenazim, which is very common, commonly used, it sounds like English, but it is not. There is no "im" to mention plural in English. This is a Hebrew word that is written in an English way, and people use it as such. But this is very poor English. If you want to say Ashkenaz in plural, you need to say Ashkenazik or Ashkenaziks. It's kind of hurts, but that's the way it should be. So that's what it means. The Eid edition. Now, another way of thinking of these two hypotheses is that the Rindlin hypothesis suggests that if it sounds like a duck, then it's a duck, whereas the Slavic Irano-Turkic hypothesis says that no, it may look like a fish, but actually you have to cut it and look at the internal organization, and just because it swims and looks like a fish, it's actually a completely different animal. And of course, every hypothesis has its own historical description that it follows. It's already been presented very briefly. The first hypothesis suggests a Germanic origin for the language, okay, some German dialect that became Yiddish. The other hypothesis suggests that Yiddish has been developed in the Khazarian Empire, relaxified during the time Jews did in Kiev and Rus, and finally got its final form in the Sorbian areas in Germany. Now, if you take 10 random linguists and put them in a room and ask them, if you follow the Rindlin hypothesis, go to this side of the room, and if you follow the believe in the other hypothesis, go to the other side of the room, maybe 9 of them would go to the first wall, and perhaps 1 would go to the other side of the room, and very likely because they misunderstood the question. That's the state of acceptance of these two hypotheses. Rindlin has been adopted by people who also believe Jews have Levantine origin, whereas the Slavo-Irano-Turkic hypothesis, championed by Paul Wexler, professor in Tel Aviv University, and possibly a few others, linguists who adopted this hypothesis. Now, the main challenges for any hypothesis is to answer the following three questions. What is the meaning of the name Ashkenaz? Okay, it's a long word. It is not associated with any known toponym, so place name. So how did it come about? How did Ashkenazic Jews become affiliated with that name, Ashkenaz? Why did Yiddish appear in the 9th century? And how can we explain the large presence of Jews in Eastern Europe in the 19th century? The rationale of our study is as follows. If we assume that the history of Yiddish mirrors the history of Yiddish speakers, we should be able to take the DNA of Yiddish speakers, run it through the geographic population structure GPS algorithm that we developed in a previous study. GPS converts DNA data into geographical regions, and wherever GPS would predict those Yiddish speakers to, that would be the place where the Yiddish speakers' genomes has been finalized, received their genetic final genetic touch, and that would also be the birthplace of Yiddish. That's easily said and done. Where would we find the DNA of Yiddish speakers? Solely Yiddish speakers, that's a big challenge. Although I thought until I remembered that I designed the database of the genographic project of the National Geographic. And when we designed this database, we allowed people to annotate their genome and tell us where their parents are from and what language or languages they speak. Fortunately, by the time the Yiddish study took place, already over 250,000 public participants participated in the genographic project. They already submitted their DNA data. They filled the annotations. So we had a very large database at our disposal. And remarkably, 4% of public participants were Jews. Most of them were Ashkenazi Jews. That was it's twice their population size, but based on the number of inquiries I'm getting, I would guess they're like 60% of the participants are Jews, but 4% were good enough for us. We had 367 Ashkenazi Jews who reported that both their parents were Ashkenazi Jews, and we were able to split them into two almost even groups. The first one, we call them solely Yiddish speakers. These are people who told us that both their parents speaks only Yiddish. This was really great for us because that would suggest that if those parents speak only Yiddish, that's because their parents, or the grandparents of the users, would only speak Yiddish, right? And so on and so forth. So presumably that would be more homogeneous groups, whereas the other half of the Ashkenazi Jews, their parents spoke multiple languages. So we expected this group to be more heterogeneous. So how does GPS work? Well, it starts with selecting ancestry informative markers. So these are a special group of genetic mutation in the genome that have a very strong geographical affinity. So the mutation that you see on the screen right now, as you can see, the A allele only exists in Southeast Asia. So this is pretty good, because if you come to us and you're saying, hey, I have this A allele in that particular marker, we can predict that you're from Southeast Asia and we'll never be wrong. Presumably these populations shown here represent the remaining populations. So this is a very powerful mutation. And if you have a lot of those, such as 100,000 or so, then you can make very accurate biogeographical predictions with any population that you have. So having this group of SNPs, and we published this in the GenoChip, it's the name of the chip I designed for the genographic project. This is when those markers were first identified and recorded. The next step. In the next step, we genotyped on the GenoChips 645 individuals from all over the world, and we ran admixture analysis on them with various number of splits. So in this analysis, we're telling the tool, assume that once, long time ago, there existed 9, 10, 11, 12 populations that were unmixed, and assume that they came about, and we want you to split the ancestry of modern day populations according to these hypothetical ancestors. So this is just a model. We don't think this story is true. We don't think such event happened. We just think it's a very useful model to capture the biodiversity of human populations. And as you can see, this tool made all those splits, and of those, we selected the 9 splits because they corresponded with what we know of history of these studied populations. And we took those putative ancestral populations that admixture created for us, and we simulated putative individuals. So now we have individuals that would be the ancestors, hypothetical ancestors of modern humans from 9 geographical regions. The next step, we ask for our modern day populations from which gene pools your genome come from, and we summarize the results in this bar. So every bar is one individual, and the difference in colors represent a different proportion of gene pools for every individual. And what you see here is very interesting results. You can see that everyone are mixed, which is great because we didn't want to replace one bad racial model with another. You can see that the gene pools are very well localized. So, for example, Africans all have the 2 African, South African and Sub-Saharan African, the purple and the red gene pools, and we almost don't see them outside of Africa. Likewise, the Native Americans, so the yellow component, we don't see it very much outside of Africa, just a tiny bit in Russians, which would be expected from the shared history, but not outside of it. So this was a really good result. But the most important one was that adjacent populations showed similar admixture proportions. And that's very encouraging because we didn't have all the world populations represented in this panel. However, having neighboring populations showing similar trends suggests that we can potentially make predictions for populations that we do not have, as long as we have their surrounding populations. So how do we move from these to make biogeographical predictions? Well, we take the mean admixture signature of every population and we place it on the map like this. Okay, it's the same exact representation as before, except now it's in a pie chart. Before it was in a bar. And there comes the individuals that asks us, where am I from? So we have a 9 numbers vector proportions, sums to 1, and we have the same exact proportions for all those pie charts. And the next thing we're going to do, we're going to calculate the Euclidean distance between these individuals and the remaining reference populations. And we can rank this by genetic similarity. So if you're more similar, you will be in red, and if you're less similar, you're going to be in blue. And next thing, the GPS algorithm will kick in. And what GPS algorithm will do is that the reference populations will start pulling this individual in their direction in a strength proportional to the genetic distances until a consensus is reached, which is when this sample will stop moving, and this would be the place where this sample is from. So this is why we call it geographic population structure. It was kind of reminding us the satellite navigation system that we need to maneuver our car, and there's satellites that talk to each other and get an idea of where the car is, and so forth. So how accurate is GPS? Well, it's very accurate. It's the most accurate biographical tool that has been published. Continental accuracy 100%, country accuracy 83%. Regional accuracy 66%, and then of course we show we can map people to their correct villages with very high accuracy, 1/4 of them to the right, to the, you know, to the village front porch, and half of them 15 kilometers, and then most of them 100 kilometers, compared to alternative tools, those were very high performances. So GPS was the tool we chose to map, to convert the DNA of Ashkenazi Jews into geographical coordinates. So that was part of a paper that was published in 2014 in Nature Communications with a highlight in Science, and it was very well received. So back to our work about Ashkenazic Jews. So this is what the admixture plot looks like. So you already know what it means. Every bar is individuals. You can see the Yiddish speakers in the middle, and around them are all the populations that we could master from the relevant regions. Before we will apply GPS to Ashkenazic Jews, we just wanted to test the accuracy for Eurasians. There were more populations here than in the previous paper, and it was a good practice to see just again how accurate GPS is. So what we have here are Eurasians, non-Jews, and we apply GPS to these populations, of course, without them being presented in the reference panel. And we ask how accurate the predictions are in relation to the political boundaries of their modern-day countries. Of course, I was not happy with that estimation of accuracy. Political boundaries are results of war and political processes that have nothing to do with genetics, but we have to make some decisions about that, and there won't be any good decision. But it's just worth to remember that when we miss a little bit about the borders, there may be a genetic reasons for that, some because the algorithm is inaccurate. So 95% of the people were localized 500 kilometers from their borders of their modern day countries, 82% within 200 kilometers. So that was the average of all these Eurasian populations. The good news was that the results were much better for populations who spoke languages that were very well localized. And that makes sense. If you only speak language that is not spoken outside of your country, it will be very difficult for you to get dates, you know, with other people outside of your language group. So we can expect those populations to be more homogeneous. And that's good news for our Yiddish speakers, because their language is also very well localized. Applying GPS to Ashkenazic Jews resulted in the in the following figure. The Yiddish speakers are in orange triangles. We had some people who said they're Kohens and Levites. They're shown here, and then a bit of few mountain Jews and Iranian Jews are also on the map. And the results pointed to northeastern Turkey, a region of no particular significance in Jewish history, not at all what was predicted by either theory. It was very baffling for us. So we packed some warm clothes and hiking shoes and food for several days, and we went to the nearby library, and we lived there until we found the following. We found that this region harbored primeval villages whose name most likely derived from the word Ashkenaz. So we have Ishkenaz, Ashkenaz, Ashkenaz, and Ashkuz. The last one was evacuated in the mid 7th century AD. And these are the first and only toponyms of the word Ashkenaz known to us, and there are four of them, all in the same region, and all of them are where Ashkenazic Jews were predicted to. And not only that, you can see that Ashkenazic Jews were predicted to hub of trade routes that are found in this very important regions that borders the sea. Now the city, the closest city that we have there is called Trebizond. And it was a port city that in ancient time had banks and bazaars and very strategic region to do trade with the northern regions. So whoever controlled the trade in this area would be not only portable because they had both access to sea and the land, but also very successful merchant, which made sense to us because Ashkenazic Jews were merchants. And from ancient time, in the 8th century, the word Jewish and merchants were synonymous. And traveling along the Silk routes or other trade routes, moving between East and West, was something that has been, Rabinovich already reported that it's been known for a while. Now, this is the same figure, except I added here the circles that represents where the parents of the people who participated in the study were born. Circles are proportional to the number of people. Now what you see here is that none of the people who told us where their parents were born were predicted to those places, which is surprising because this is not GPS being off. We already shown that GPS makes very accurate predictions for European non-Jews. If those people were Europeans, they would be predicted to where the circles show us. What these results tell us is that this particular cohort of Ashkenazi Jews never mixed with the European people in the places where they arrived to. They always married other Ashkenazi Jews or other migrants from the same region, and they preserved their Turkish-like genetic signature. And I'm saying Turkish here just for simplicity. Of course, by that time there were no Turks, not in those regions. I mean, this is clear, right? I mean, all people's names should be taken to in the simple manner, not in the necessarily historical one. And then we have one ancient Scythian there, and that's the square. It's ancient Scythian. Looking at the haplogroups, both maternal and paternals, they're very heterogeneous. So you can forget all about the single ancestors hypothesis that a lot of people preach. I mean, you can see it's not in the cards. What is more interesting than this hypothesis is that the Yiddish, solely Yiddish speakers show slightly different trends from the multilingual Ashkenazi Jews, as in they retained haplogroups of East Asian origins. So in the Y group, that would be the Q1B. In the mitochondria, that would be such haplogroups such as T2. So these are East Asian origins, and they were lost in the multilingual Ashkenazic Jews, presumably because just drift over time made them disappear. Okay, so as we suspected, the solely Yiddish speakers were more homogeneous groups and were able to preserve more ancient signatures. But how do we know that GPS did not place Ashkenazic Jews in Turkey because they're half Levantines and half Russians, for example? So to answer this question, we did some simulation. So we used the model that you see on the left top part. That's the model. That's a distribution of the gene pools in Eurasia. From this model, we can generate individuals that would be native to every region according to the model. Okay, so we generated some, we call them Khazarian, Kafkazian, we generate some Ashkenazic Turks. So from the model, we generate people that would be native to those regions. And you can see in C the places that we selected to generate those archaic individuals. In D, you can see where GPS predicted them to. If you're from, simulated Levantines were all predicted to the Levant, but simulated Iranians, only half of them, less than half, were predicted to Iran's, and some were predicted to Turkey, and some were predicted elsewhere. Why? Because the Iranians were very, very heterogeneous, and this entire region does not have very good, strong geographic signature related to genetics. So Iranians are a bit all over the place. Why is that important? Because that would tell us just how reliable those findings are. In D, you can see that the Ashkenazic Jews were all predicted to Turkey. Okay. Now in E, what you see is the genetic similarity between Ashkenazic Jews and everyone else. So Ashkenazic Jews are quite homogeneous. You see the genetic distance within the group is close to zero, but the next population they're closest to are the Khazarian Kafkazians, which is not surprising because if you look at C, there is a bit of overlap. Some of those Khazars were sampled from Turkey. These are the boundaries of the empire. And followed by high genetic similarity to the Ashkenazic Turks, which are predicted very well to Turkey from the model. In other words, if Ashkenazi Jews were half Levantines and half Russians, they would not show high similarity to these populations. Okay, So from those results, we know that the Ashkenazic Jews were predicted to Turkey because they look very much like model native, ancient Turks, rather than a mixture of two or more different populations. In F, you can see the proportion of different clusters within our database and their similarity to all these simulated individuals. So most of the Ashkenazi Jews show high similarity to the Khazarian Caucasians, and the priests look like the Turkish, northeastern Turkish ones. What does it all tell us? We remind you, our goal was to address the question of origin of Ashkenazi Jews and their language, which have been some of the most debated language questions in genetics history and linguistics over the past 300 years. Genetics, of course, a little bit less. And just a reminder, the main challenges for any hypothesis are to explain the meaning of the word Ashkenaz, the appearance of Yiddish in the 9th century, and the large presence of Jews in Eastern Europe in the 19th century. Ashkenaz is mentioned in the Bible in three contexts, twice in the context of Noah's grandson, and the third one as the prophecy that Jeremiah provides, whereas one day the three kingdoms, Ashkenaz, Minai, and Aratru, Urartu, would wage war on Babylon. They didn't really like the Babylonians for obvious reasons, but that kind of gives us a sense of where Ashkenaz can be. And it's not in Germany, because it would not make any sense. It should be somewhere in this region. Ashkenaz is the in Akkadian is Ashkuz or Ishkuza, and it refers to the people who the Greek called the Scythians. And this is their location. In the orange part, Babylon resided in Parthia and south. So you can see why this prophecy makes sense geographically. Our predictions were a bit, in northeastern Turkey, so just the edge of the Scythian Empire. But this entire region was called Ashkenaz, and presumably these names over time was lost. I don't need to tell you, there is a process of changing certain names to other names to support the ambitious of whoever lives there in Israel. It's being done all the time, and possibly in Turkey as well. So names disappearing, ancient names disappearing. So we're very fortunate to recover these ones thanks to our GPS telling us where to look for. So how did Ashkenazic Jews became affiliated with this name? So this question is not clear, but we already know that this name has been called Ashkenaz for a very long time, and we know that Jews were traders. By the first century, most of the Jews in the world resided in the Iranian Empire. They were descendants from Judean emigrants, or most likely from local converts to Judaism that were extremely active in international trade. Over time, many of them moved north to the Khazarian Empire to expand their commercial operations. Later on, they influenced the religion reform in the Khazarian Empire, where the Khazarian Empire is converted to Judaism. There is no doubt about that. Consequently, not only the Turkish rulers converted to Judaism, but a lot of other Eastern Slavs and other members of the empire of the elite converted to Judaism, so they can participate in the very profitable trade between Europe and China. That was a Jewish monopoly. And we speculate that Yiddish emerged at that time as a secret language to give Jews advantage in trade. And it was based on Slavic and Iranian patterns. Now, anyone who speaks foreign language and shops in stores that where there is another prevalent language spoken can understand the advantages we're talking about. I mean, you can manipulate prices. You can ask the guy, your worker, how much does this cost, and then set to the person twice that price. And you either suffered or benefited from this phenomenon, but hopefully you know what I mean. But this raises the questions. Provided Ashkenazi Jews are named after Scythians, the question is, are they Scythians? We believe that the answer is no, although in this study we did not use ancient DNA from Scythian. It is available now, so that question will need to be revisited. But for the time being, we believe that the answer is no, for several reasons. First of all, we are not certain about the exact ancestry of the ancestors of Ashkenazic Jews. As said before, it's a bit difficult without ancient DNA, and it's only just now being published. Nonetheless, the term Ashkenazi is already a very large clue as to the Iranian origin of the group that inhabited the central Eurasian steppes. At that time, there were also Greeks there and Slavs, so it's quite a hub of people of Irano, Greco-Roman, Slavic origin. So why did they call themselves Scythians? Well, at that time, Scythians were not there anymore, but their memories remained. Their language was not spoken at that time. It disappeared, but the name remained. And the annotation of the Bible gave it a very a certain glory. Not to mention the Scythians were very fearsome warriors. The Greeks were absolutely fascinated with them, the story of the Amazon and so forth. And you always call yourselves after a higher and stronger culture. That's why the Judeans call themselves Israelites. That this was a two different kingdom, right? And Israel was gone. There were exiles. The 10 tribes were exiled, and the remaining sort of lost their identity. The Judeans adopted those people who remained and their Israelite identity. And we called ourselves Israelites, even though we're not really considered ourselves related to that large collective, but rather to the Judean tribes. Likewise, these people in ancient Ashkenaz lands, they lived in a region that was called Ashkenaz. They had the villages whose names derived from Ashkenaz. And there were those very cool people who were called also Ashkuza. So they adopted the name at least for a while. And potentially they also saw themselves sharing ancestry with those people. Now, what happened to that name, to this identity, Ashkenaz identity, after they left? That's a very fascinating question. So why, when and why was Yiddish invented? So because there were so many Jewish communities along major trade routes who share religion, common culture, and history, they developed Yiddish as a secret language so they can maintain their political and spiritual unity and gain advantage in trade. This conclusion is supported by two form of evidence. The first one is linguistic. There are 250 words of buying and selling in Yiddish. So this is a language of traders. And you can see just how many there is in English. The second one is the genetic evidence. You can see the genome of Ashkenazi Jews is being mapped to this hub of trade routes in the region that we called ancient Ashkenaz. Okay. Now, the reason they needed Yiddish and could not use Hebrew is because nobody could speak Hebrew at that time. They could pray, but it was not a spoken language, so it wasn't good. So how do we explain the large presence of Jews in Eastern Europe in the 19th century? Well, at some point, 11th century to the 13th century, Khazaria lost its prominence and the Jewish monopoly on the Silk Roads ended. This process was stimulated by several factors: invasion of the Rus, the Black Death brought by rats from Asia to Europe, and the Mongolian invasion. It was a little bit too much to ask the Khazars to maintain themselves throughout all those disasters, and the empire fell apart. Jews moved west to Ukrainian lands, and from there they moved to Germany, where German trader, where the Jewish traders already established some kind of towns. The relexification process of the language was abandoned. Yiddish, Slavic Yiddish, there were other Yiddish languages that went extinct in different parts of the world. Slavic Yiddish is the only one that survived. It's called today just Yiddish. And it became the first and only spoken written language and started absorbing more and more German words on its Slavic grammar, which is why people call it jargon or broken German. So again, why Ashkenazic Jews? Where, if Jews moved out of Ashkenaz, why haven't we heard about that term before, early on? And if it was, could it have been that it was forgotten, but some memory remained? So these are all fascinating questions. But of course there is a lot of confusion involving it. And some people believe that the only real Ashkenazic Jews are Germans, and other non-German Jews should not be called Ashkenaz. Our findings suggest otherwise. A lot of the confusion concerning this hypothesis stems from the erroneous association of the term Ashkenaz with German Germans or German lands in the 11th century. From historical perspective, the word Ashkenaz starts with the Scythians, in the and that term remained in the region. It was not the Germanic association was made only very later on. Already in the 10th century in Baghdad, it meant Slavic. So the meaning of the word changed a little bit, and only in the 11th century it was it got the word of German Yiddish speakers and so forth. However, already in the 10th century, Moroccan Kuwait philologists knew that Ashkenazic Jews descend from the Khazars and German, meaning that they came from Khazar Empire and spoke Yiddish. So you can understand this confusion. And a lot of there are several other authors who recognize Ashkenaz as the regions of the Near East. Some Caucasus Jews are still known by Ashkenazic by their neighbors. This is not because they adopted the name from German Jews. They were the first Ashkenazic Jews, which also means that those Turkish Jews, again, those people from that region in northeastern Turkey who arrived in Khazaria and later on moved to Russia and are the ancestors most likely of modern day Russians should also be properly called Ashkenazic Jews. It is not the German Jews who hold a title to that term. So of course, some people do not agree. Abtrud suggested in her response to our paper that Jewish immigrants in Europe just transferred biblical names at random into regions where they settled. This is a ridiculous proposal for several reasons. First of all, biblical names, there was not randomness involved in the process of transferring biblical names into certain regions. It would only make sense if the two names have similar sounds. Germany and Ashkenaz do not sound the same, and Germany was already known as Germana or Germania in the Iranian Talmud. It was associated with Noah's other grandson, Gomer. For name adoption to occur, the two names need to have kind of similar sounds, like Sfard and Spain. This is not the case here. Ashkenaz has very clear geographical affinity that no one doubts that it's in the Near East, and that explanation that Abtrud proposed is simply not necessary. Germany was also known by French scholars, Jewish French scholars like the Radak as Almania, after the Almani tribes, and that name was also adopted by Arab scholars. So the questionable interpretation of Rashi as Ashkenaz that is often being made here to sustain the association of Ashkenaz with Germany is simply incorrect. Radak came after Rashi. He's used his language, his symbol, so obviously he could read what Rashi wrote, and he would not make that mistake, as in ignoring what Rashi called Germany, supposedly Ashkenaz, and call it Almania instead. So these associations associated with Rashi is simply incorrect. Rashi did not mean Germany when he used the word Ashkenaz. Yiddish is a Slavic language. Paul Wexler's excellent book in our study brings several cultural evidence to support this. Two of them, known ones, are breaking glass in a wedding ceremony and placing stones on graves. Surely you've seen it if you're Jews, or if you haven't Jews, you didn't understand why there are rocks on graves, but that's a Slavic Jewish practice. Breaking a stone, of course, is very well known today as Jewish practice, but it's Slavic origin. Now, I don't know how it is done in Slavic lands, but in Israel, they're not using glass. They're using some very, very thin form of glass, and you can see it should be wrapped in some kind of napkin, because and every year there is this guy who buy those cheap shoes and ends up in the hospital because or use real glass because they forgot that special glass. so it's kind of risky practice. Don't try it at home. These are Yiddish practices. So how do those result in respect to the remaining literature? Well, oddly enough, they're in general agreement with the findings of other studies, of course, not necessarily their conclusions. There is a very well-known bias in the fields where people feel that it is necessary to show that Ashkenazic Jews are from the Levant for obvious reasons that have nothing to do with science. But they were never able to show that convincingly, or else there wouldn't be so many studies trying to do so. The vast majority of genetic studies found that Ashkenazi Jews are very similar to either Near Eastern populations or South European populations, Greeks, Italians, but never to Bedouins and Palestinians, if you take in account other populations. Of course, if you only test Bedouins and Palestinians, and English, you would find that Jews are closer to the Levantines one than the English ones. But and that's one way to bias these kind of studies. But if you use a wide array of populations, the first ones will come up more similar than the Levantine ones. Of course, with very few exceptions, such findings of Near Eastern and South Europeans are being interpreted or should have been misinterpreted in favor of Middle Eastern Judean ancestry. Although the results do not support that. Then there are several ways of conjuring Middle Eastern origin, despite of the findings, and our paper has discussed them at length here, just very briefly. One way is that whatever you find, let's say you find Southern Europe, such as Selding and colleagues found, so that would be the Europeans from, right? Then you'd say, oh yes, it's consistent with the Mediterranean origin because, South Europe borders the Mediterranean, hence the connection to the Middle East, hence Jews are from the Middle East, which is anyone who would read the study understands as the Levant. The Middle East is a very large region. Harbors the Levant. The Levant would just be Israel, maybe bits of Lebanon and Turkey. That would be the Levant. But when somebody studies says we found Jews to the Middle East, the connection they want you to make in your head is that they map it to Israel, which is not the case. Another way of reporting the results, like Rusti et al. Did, they declared that it is part of the Near East. So they map Jews to the Caucasus region, which they call the Near East, and instead of calling it Middle East, now it's the Near East, and apparently the Levant is part of the Middle East now, of the Near East, and also the Ashkenazic Levite that they tested. Very common fallacy that is made is saying that Ashkenazic Jews are very, very similar to one another, hence they have a Middle Eastern origin. So Koppelman and colleagues did that, for example, And hopefully you understand that one does not entail the other. Genetic similarity within a cohort is not automatically linked to the Levant. I mean, Chinese are more similar to each other than other populations, but they're not from the Levant. So one does not allow you to deduce the other one. But you can see how they're saying it. They're saying that because they share genetic similarity, it means that they also share a common Middle Eastern ancestry, although this has never been shown in their study. Tian and colleagues dismissed very similar findings. Again, the Ashkenazi Jews are similar to one another and similar to Caucasus population. So it should have been, the conclusion should have been that they share common ancestry with the Caucasus, but Tian et al. Decided that Jews are aliens, and that in their case, the results do not mean that they have a non-Levantine geographical origins. And what is very, very common to do is to make the argument that you found similarity with non-Jews that are not in the Levant because those people in the past were Jews. And that kind of argument is the same one that is being made in religion. It cannot be refuted. If you decide that any similarity you find because Jews and non-Jews, it is because the non-Jews were actually Jews, there is no way to test that, but also no way to refute that. And that's a very common argument to make. And it's not being made only with regarding Turks and the Caucasus. You can see it with Latinos and essentially every population Ashkenazi Jews show similarity to, because they're a very heterogeneous population. And there is lots of coming in and mixing and so on and so forth. They are expected to show similarity to other populations. But rather than interpreting the data in that way, consistent with historical data that we have, it is being interpreted as the other guy is a Jew, he just doesn't know that. And that allows a genetic testing company to make a lot of money. So such argument was made recently by Behar and colleagues that traced Ashkenazic Jew to Eastern Europe, Eastern Turkey, but instead of interpreting the data such as Turkish origin, which they should have, that was the logic of their analysis, they claimed that those people share Levantine, where it says Middle Eastern in this context, that means Levantine origin with Jews. Hence, this is why Jews are in Turkey. So no matter where Jews are going to be predicted, it's because the other guy is a Jew, just doesn't know that. And we're going back to Levant. You can understand it's a nonsense argument, but that's the one being made. Atzmon and colleagues also found that Northern Italians show greatest proximity to Ashkenazic Jews, followed by other Italians and French, which should have been interpreted as a non-Semitic Mediterranean ancestry. Instead, they decided Ashkenazic Jews demonstrate a Middle Eastern ancestry based on absolutely nothing. The same authors also interpreted different patterns of genetic segments that are IBD, so very long stretches of genome, very similar to other populations, but they explain the data in the demographic miracle rather than explain it as scientists should without using miracles. So far as I know, no large-scale study has reported that Ashkenazi Jews are genetically closer to Germans or Israelite populations when compared with Near Eastern and Southern European populations. In our analysis, all biogeographical analysis, Bedouins and Palestinians are the only populations localized to Israel, not Druze. Druze are from the Caucasus and the Syrian region as well. So this paper was received quite well. The number of readers in the first couple of weeks estimated in the millions. This is the unfortunately only third most read paper in genome biology and evolution. I find it quite hard to top the first two that one I wrote and the other one is a highlight. The fifth one has nothing to do with Ashkenazic Jews, but you're still welcome to read it. And we're able to do some citizen science to allow people to take part of future research or just if they want, or just use GPS to study their own origins. So I developed this tool for DNA Diagnostic Center. It's called the GPS Origins. It is much more advanced than the GPS I just presented in many ways. For once, it has uses a much larger number of gene pools, so it allows to hone the signal, the ancestry signal, much better. It uses a very large panel of reference populations, so I think it's over 1,000 reference populations, and it doesn't yield a single point of origin like GPS does. It yields two, roughly corresponding to two paternal parental lines. And each line also has some migration route, which is how the DNA traveled along very long time. Of course, this is not the migration of a single person. This is how the DNA, where the DNA turned, as in which populations it shows lesser similarities. And the full analysis will also give you the timestamps and events that led to this prediction. But these results that you see on the screens are for Russian Jew. And interestingly, you can see the two lines converged in the region of ancient Ashkenaz and as they moved on together to Turkey. I felt it was quite a romanticized result that this person got. And of course, when you have such wide reception of a paper, it is unavoidable to have some criticism. Two critical opinion papers were published. We responded to the first one in very details, and again, the first and the second one, our response is summarized here. I'm not going to discuss their criticism in detail. I don't think it is very interesting. None of them discussed the major finding, which is the primeval villages and the link between genetics and geography, which we demonstrated. They just want to, you know, say that they don't agree with the results, and they have the right to do so, but I have the right to ignore it, at least in this presentation. Our detailed response is in those papers, and I'm not gonna I don't want to waste time this reviewing it. What I would like to talk about a little bit is the second response that we provided. Not the response itself, but the added analysis that we did. The top figure shows you a summary of all biogeographical predictions ever made for Ashkenazic Jews. So it has the 2013 paper, the Behart al results, and then the Dasset al results. They were all made based on different data sets of Ashkenazi Jews using three different methods, and you can see they all converge in Turkey. Okay, I'm absolutely fascinated that my 2013 very limited biogeographical methods yield the same results as GPS. Behar's method is just off, but as you can see, it is not in Israel, and that of course is not what the authors reported. They just ignored their own results. So this is a summary of findings on biogeographical localization of Ashkenazi Jews. The figure below already was done at a time where ancient DNA data became sufficient to allow further exploration of more ancient origins. And what you see here is a supervised admixture analysis where we ask, for modern-day populations, to which ancient populations do you most look like? So these European hunter-gatherers, Anatolians, Levantines, and Iranians, they're all ancient populations whose DNA was sequenced from skeletons and mummies. Of course, they're all from different times. We didn't have the luxury with these limited data to select it to reflect a particular time. So it is a bit limited. But nonetheless, you can see that when all things are equal, Levantine populations show very high similarity to ancient Levantines, whereas Ashkenazi Jews show similarity to ancient Iranians, in agreement with our results above and the findings from of the Dasset al paper that Ashkenazi Jews are of Iranian origin. Okay, so this is completely consistent with the ancient DNA evidence. And that paper also did very well in Frontiers. Two popular science articles that I wrote for the conversation also did very well. So there are about 500 readers per day. And I think in my institution, I'm ranked top 10 most read author. And here too, with the rise of ancient DNA sciences and the progress made in this field by others and of course our group, we also wanted to allow some citizen science, allow people experience with the data and experiment with it. A different company called DNA Consultants agreed to develop to make available the primeval DNA test that I developed. Interestingly, we have ancient Israelites in the as one of the populations that that people can test with. So this is one example of results. There are other screens I'm not showing here of a person who took the test, and that's the genetic similarity that they have with all these different skeletons that, you know, we give them names to make it more fun, and every skeleton has their own story. And you can see that the highest similarity is with ancient DNA, that ancient person that we call Gal. I believe she's a Neolithic female. Yes. So to summarize, our study aimed to answer major questions regarding the term Ashkenaz, the origin of Ashkenaz Jews, and Yiddish, in light of two prevailing hypotheses, the Rhineland hypothesis, the Rhino-Turco-Slavic hypothesis. Our findings supported the Rhino-Turco-Slavic hypothesis. We found no evidence whatsoever for a Levantine origin. Later analysis that we used ancient DNA sustained those findings. In fact, there is no evidence for a Levantine origin in the literature. All we have are results being interpreted, or again, misinterpreted, in favor of Middle Eastern origin, or most likely the Near Eastern origins in the Caucasus and Turkey represented as are being misinterpreted as being a midway between the Levant and Europe. Again, there is no evidence for this. This is just wishful thinking and a lot of bad science. I'm certainly not going to read the whole thing. It's all summarized in the paper below. But those results produce a new history for Ashkenazic Jews, where the origin of the people was from God-fearers communities that resided in the Black Sea. At some point, they fully converted to Judaism. The only difference between God-fearers and a Jew is circumcision. They probably had one rabbi too many coming from Iran and beginning this process, which took a very long time to be established, but making circumcision more prevalent than it used to be. There was a reason why they opposed circumcision, more than one, but that's a story for a different time. And after that, they moved on following unpleasant events they experienced in Turkey. So there was, of course, the Muslim invasion, and there was some climate change and other geopolitical changes that made Turkey not desirable anymore, and they moved into possible directions: one, the northern direction to the Khazarian Empire, and the westward direction toward Italy. So that's these are the conclusions of my study. You're very welcome to read more of our academic work in my website. There are a lot of other popular science articles. This is my YouTube channel. I'm also available on Twitter and my blog. Thank you for watching.